This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Gritty, soulful vocals, dizzying twin guitars, and a punishing rhythm section. That's what's in store later this hour with an encore of our segment from earlier this year featuring conversation and live music from the Fort Myers rock and roll band, The Electric Mud. But first, from the iconic yellow label to the consistent ranking among the top-selling champagnes in the world, Veuve Clicquot is a bit of an institution in the modern wine world, but the chateau was near ruin throughout the Napoleonic Wars. After the death of her husband, it took a series of risks by Barbet Nicole Clicquot-Ponsardin, the 27-year-old widow, or Veuve in French. Her story is told in a book titled The Widow Clicquot, written by scholar, winemaker, and professor Dr. Tilar Mazzeo, who's originally from Port Charlotte. She'll be in Naples doing a book signing at the wine store on Central Avenue tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. I had a chance to talk with her earlier this week. We're going to listen to that conversation now, but because it's pre-taped, we can't take calls. Feel free, though, to connect via social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. What got you interested in writing about the widow Clicquot?
So I had had a job early in my career in Wisconsin, and I had recently come out of both the Washington and then the Oregon wine country, and so was already really interested in wine, but decided that the best way to get through Wisconsin winters was to start studying French Champagne seriously as a project.
That makes sense.
And it really started just kind of accidentally. I mean, I was already really interested in wine. But some girlfriends and I agreed that Veuve Clicquot was our favorite champagne. So we used to get together and bring a bottle and do girl things. And one day I remember just saying to my girlfriends, you know, Widow Clicquot, Veuve Clicquot means widow in French. I wonder if there really was a Veuve Clicquot. And that was really how it started, is it would just, as a joke, every time we met, I would come in and I'd bring this information about this woman, and ultimately decided that I thought that there was a great story in the Widow Clicquot and who this woman who is an entrepreneur and a winemaker and revolutionized champagne as a product and, you know, helped make it the iconic drink that it is. I thought that would be a story that I probably wasn't the only one interested in.
Well, this kind of fell hand in hand with your background, and it seems like in your body of work you've written about some legendary women. You wrote a bit about Mary Shelley, Irina Sendler, Eliza Hamilton. What is it that attracts you to write about these women in history?
Yeah, you know, I mean, early on, my real interest was in women who were entrepreneurs, right? I mean, in the beginning, that was kind of how it started, is I always just thought that business women don't sometimes get enough street cred. And partly it was, you know, my mom is this really brilliant businesswoman, so I grew up with a mom who was an incredibly talented business person, and just have always admired women who kind of break the mold and go out there and build something. So it had started there, and then later I just became interested in the stories of women who did what they weren't supposed to do and, you know, did really, really amazing things. So someone like Eliza Hamilton, you know, she's not a businesswoman, but, you know, her role was not really just a supporting role behind Alexander Hamilton. The musical is fabulous, but the musical is not entirely, I think, fair to Eliza. She's more than just a woman betrayed. I don't think that's her whole story. Or, you know, Irina Sendler was a social worker living in Warsaw during the German occupation, and she and a group of girlfriends saved 2,500 children from the Warsaw ghetto. And then kept a list with their names so that after the war, their families could find them if they survived. So just women who do amazing things. I think those stories aren't told often enough still.
Yeah, I think it's really an incredibly attractive subject to want to study. So when you first started out looking into the life of Veuve Clicquot, the widow Clicquot, where did you start?
And I wrote to Veuve Clicquot, and I just asked the archivist there if I could have access. And they fortunately wrote back and said, yeah. So I went over to France. And the only thing that was tricky about that is that when I arrived there, although there's this whole library at the Maison dedicated to her archives, the thing that was interesting was that she kept all these business records and, you know, all the entrepreneurial records, but she didn't keep a lot about her personal life. So I thought that it would be really easy from the beginning to tell the story of her character, but in the end, the really hard research was finding the places where people who met her firsthand talked about what she was like as a person. And that ended up taking me to libraries across, especially the United States. I found a lot of the information in the Huntington Library in Southern California. They had a collection of travel narratives where people had gone and visited her toward the end of her life. And then I also, by the time I finished the book, was living in Sonoma County, California, and I wanted to understand women winemakers and how champagne was really made, and so I reached out to a number of the women who make sparkling wine in the California wine country, who were incredibly generous with, you know, kind of a hands-on education on the wine side of things.
So let's start at the beginning of her life. She was born in a time of revolution.
Yeah, she was a young girl during the French Revolution, and her father was a deeply political man who started out supporting the monarchy, and then when the French Revolution started, decided that maybe he supported the revolutionaries instead. there's a story of her as a child having to flee the revolution, and her marriage actually took place because religion was outlawed after the French Revolution, right? She actually was married in secret in a wine cellar in a Catholic ceremony, which I always thought was fitting.
Yeah, that sounds fitting. But we talked earlier, you said it was an arranged marriage, but then it evolved into an actually loving marriage.
Yeah, it started out as really her father and her husband's father were both magnates in the textile industry. And they had barely met each other. I mean, he had been away doing a business education in Switzerland in the years immediately preceding the marriage. So they may have known each other as younger people, but there was no romance. It was two dads agreeing that they were going to consolidate a business empire and marry a son and a daughter. But amazingly, they have this wonderful love story where her husband decides he doesn't really want to be in the textile industry. He really, really wants to learn about the wine industry and to sell local wine as a négociant. And he convinces his father to let him try. And because he doesn't know anything about the wine industry, he kind of does this crash course in driving around in the carriage asking the local winemakers to help him understand what he needs to know. And he invites his wife to do it. And so it is driving around in the Champagne learning about wine together, which becomes a shared passion that they fall in love with each other.
So she was included in his learning curve. It did not go very well, and he passed away 6 years after they were married?
Yeah, it didn't go very well. The business that he wanted to start was a failure. His dad had warned him that it was a very difficult time to be starting in the wine trade because it was in the midst now of the Napoleonic Wars. And so war is a really hard time to be exporting wine because, of course, the one ship that you really want to capture is that ship full of French champagne.
Yeah.
If you're the other side. So it was just very, very difficult economic conditions, and it did not go well at all. You know, the amazing part of it is that by the time her husband dies, the business is a failure. At that point, she goes to her father-in-law, who really was not in support of the business at all, and asks if she can be given an opportunity, and really the equivalent of what was today about $1 million, to try to start that business herself. At a time when women just did not run businesses, especially women of her class position. And amazingly, he says yes and gives her a chance.
And she's 27.
Mm-hmm. She's 27.
And so he takes a chance on her and gives her a business partner.
He gives her a business partner, a man named Alexander Fourneau, who is known to history as the man who founded what is today Taittinger's. His job is to basically give her a kind of crash course MBA. And so for 4 years, they work as business partners while she's meant to be learning the business ropes, as it were. And at the end of those 4 years, they've lost $1 million. They're about ready to go bankrupt again. And Fourneau says, "I'm out. This is crazy. This is not the business to run." And at that point, she goes back to her father-in-law again and asks him to essentially bankroll another $1 million and let her try one more time. And I always thought the most amazing part of the story was the fact that he said yes.
That kind of tells you something about her character, the fact that somebody's willing to gamble on her not once but twice. And
exactly.
It's a significant amount of money.
It was a huge amount of money, and I mean, it was jeopardizing really her financial security. I mean, she didn't need to work, right? By the time her husband had died, she was a wealthy young widow, and, you know, she could have lived a life of luxury. But I think for her, she'd fallen in love with wine, and I think there was a way in which, because she'd also fallen in love with her husband, what she thought is, you know, I'm going to do this thing that was our shared dream. So she was incredibly and passionately committed to the idea of making this a business a success. So she tries a second time, and by then she's on the edge of bankruptcy a second time, and she knows that she's not going to get a third chance. And so she comes up with this idea, and, you know, her arch rival is Jean-Remy Moët of Moët and Chandon. And he took a really dim view of the idea that a woman should be trying to run a business. He's not pro business women.
Mm-hmm.
And he really has captured the market share in the Russian market, which is the primary market for French champagne at that moment. And so she comes up with this idea, and she thinks that if she could smuggle her 1811 vintage, which was one of the two great vintages, so a wonderful wine, she thinks, well, if I could just run the blockades and smuggle it to a port right outside Russia so that when Napoleon is defeated, which she knew was coming, I could beat Jean-Remy Moët to the Russian market, and I could capture some of that market share, and maybe I could save the business. And so she does. She takes this amazing gamble. She smuggles about 10,000 bottles of wine. If the wine is captured, she would be destroyed, right? It was really a high stakes.
That was her Hail Mary pass, right?
It was a Hail Mary pass, absolutely. And she sends a salesman, a man named Louis Bond, to go and deliver it because, amazingly, although in the end she sold wine as far as places like Lapland. I mean, I don't know who was buying champagne in Lapland, but there are records showing she sold wine to Lapland before it was all over.
Mm-hmm.
She never traveled outside of France because it was still a moment where a woman who didn't have a male protector couldn't travel. So she really relies on Louis Bon. And I think, I don't write about this too much in the book because I kind of came across some of it later. But I think there's, looking at the letters of Louis Bon, I think Louis Bon probably had, you know, a thing for her as well. I think there mm-hmm. might have been a kind of second love story there, although it was unrequited on his part. So she sends him, and he manages to get the wine to the port. The war does end. And he writes this fabulous letter back to her where he says, you know, I can't even unload the wine off the boat. Like, people are lining up outside the boat to buy your champagne, and they're raving about how amazing it is. And we were joking, you know, he doubles the price.
That's great.
And, you know, she really just, I mean, this, and then the champagne of the Widow Clicquot becomes what everybody wants. It's just this absolutely sort of meteoric rise to success within weeks.
So she became the main brand of champagne, and that happened on a global scale. So that was a big change. How did that impact things there back at the winery?
Well, so then she has all these orders pouring in, and everybody wants her wine. And the problem is that she's got a logjam in the cellar, that she can't produce it fast enough. I mean, the problem with champagne as a product is that the reason it's more expensive is it's incredibly laborious to make champagne. Because not only do you go through a first fermentation, then you bottle it, then you put it through a secondary fermentation that creates the bubbles, and then you have to figure out how to get rid of the yeast that's in the bottle before you can sell the wine. And that was the real technical problem that held champagne back from being a mass market product, always artisanal, but mass produced, because the old way of doing it was just pouring it from one bottle to another. And so she agonized over how she was going to speed up the production to fill these orders so she didn't lose the market share. And she invents what is still today the gold standard in how you make vintage sparkling wine. She invents a technique called riddling, and it's basically a way of turning the wine upside down so that the yeast goes to the neck of the bottle, and then you pop the cork off, and you have a really, really fast thumb, and you've got rid of the yeast plug, effectively, that at the end of the bottle, and now you have this brilliantly clear champagne. And this was much, much faster than the previous technique. And what's amazing is that there are also some wonderful letters of Jean-Remy Moët saying, what is she doing?
How is she keeping it so effervescent?
Right. Well, how is she doing it so fast? And I always think that the fact that her employees kept that a secret in a small town for nearly a decade so that, you know, her competitors did not find out what was going on says something really important about who she was as a person and the kind of loyalty that she inspired in her employees as well.
Yeah, it's funny because you said that you didn't have a whole lot of actual information there on the ground other than accounting and, you know, specific numbers and things like that, and yield numbers and stuff. But that kind of stuff is what you have to fill in as a writer by she had to be pretty cool and her people had to really like her to keep something like that a secret because that's very valuable information.
Exactly. I mean, you can extrapolate from those kinds of things. I mean, there are some accounts in the 19th century, you know, of tourists who went and met her. But what we don't have is, you know, we don't have very many letters where she writes, you know, and talks about her personal feelings. I mean, there is one wonderful letter late in her life that she writes to her granddaughter where it's kind of the most personal letter we have, where she says, you know, you have to act with audacity and you have to grab the things of tomorrow. So, and that letter's in there. That's a wonderful letter where she, you know, is giving advice to her granddaughter, who is a very old woman. But yeah, otherwise, her own voice, she didn't preserve her own voice. So we see her through the eyes of other people.
Are there any wines that have survived from her time?
Well, yes, you know, they had found, remember a couple of years ago in that shipwreck somewhere off the coast of Scandinavia? They found in a ship that had gone down 19th century, I think it was a whole case of it, 19th century Veuve Clicquot. And I know that they do display one of those bottles at the Maison in France. I've seen that. And I know that I was not, unfortunately, invited to be among the people who got to taste one of those bottles. But I know people who did. So.
Oh, what did they say? Had it held up?
Yeah, apparently it had held up because it was stored in cold anaerobic conditions, right, at the bottom of the sea. So it had held up, perfectly. One of the things, though, that is always interesting to me about champagne from that period, and I write a little bit about it in the book, you know, I had talked to Eileen Crane, is the winemaker at Domaine Carneros in Napa, and she was one of the people who had helped me understand this, that, you know, champagne from the Widow Clicquot's period was nothing like champagne today. So it had, it was incredibly sweet. Sometimes it had up to 300 grams of residual sugar, which is basically not quite twice as sweet, but almost twice as sweet as something like a Sauternes, right? Like one of the sweetest dessert wines on the market.
That's really sweet.
Incredibly sweet. And at a time when, of course, sugar was a real luxury product, right? So it was very, very sweet. And it was served like almost ice slush cold because ice was the other luxury product. You know, if you read something like, remember reading Gone with the Wind, you know, as a teenager, and thinking, why are they so excited about ice cream? You know, I never quite got that, like why Scarlett thought ice cream was such a big deal. And it's really because ice in the summer would have been the ultimate luxury product before refrigeration. So
it was before Frigidaires, right?
Yeah, exactly. they did not have a deep freeze.
Well, plus that ice might help kind of control a little bit of the perception of that sweetness.
Exactly.
I'm surprised it's able to keep its bubbles with all that heaviness of sugar. I don't know why. I feel like the viscosity might be a little bit great also.
Yeah. And I don't, well, the other thing is they were not really very sparkling. I mean, we drink sparkling wine much more assertively sparkling than at that time. That also would not have been the case. It was much more lightly pétillant than we are now used to. So it's really in some ways not anything like what we think of as a brut champagne for sure. There's a great second part of the story where, you know, the other widow that late in her life the widow Clicquot knows is Louise Pommeret, the widow Pommeret. And Louise Pommeret is the one who discovers, you know, invents and commercializes brut champagne, you know, so that dry style that most of us drink now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it was one of the few mistakes that the widow Clicquot made, and she realized it. I mean, she was smart enough to know she'd made a mistake. So Louise Pommeret had the idea that the British, who at that point didn't buy champagne, she knew that the British would like champagne because they liked sparkling cider, and had gone to boarding school in England. But she just thought that they didn't like it quite so sweet. And the widow Clicquot thought, no, there's no way. The British are never going to buy champagne. And so Louise Pomeray starts exporting her Brut, and it suddenly becomes hugely successful. And the Widow Clicquot realizes she's made a mistake. She starts to produce her own Brut-style champagne, and that is the Yellow Label. So the history of the Yellow Veuve Clicquot label is that was the label specifically created for her Brut champagne in response to Louise Pomeray's success.
That's interesting. And then when you follow it through, I've done a couple of stories in the past about Charles Heidsieck and his forays into the United States market. How do you, I don't know if you followed this much, but did you ever follow champagne into the U.S. markets?
Yeah, Heidsieck is a great story. I mean,
yeah, that Civil War thing,
Champagne Charlie stuff.
And, oh yeah.
He was a great marketeer and businessman. I mean, he was very, very creative in his marketing and obviously did phenomenally well as a result of it. And I don't write about him in the book because it was a biography of the Widow Clicquot, but
well, of course,
he's a fabulous story. You know, what I would say is that, he's probably better at the direct marketing. I mean, he's one of the people who really, you know, helped market champagne as this iconic product. But the person who transformed it into an iconic product to begin with was the Widow Clicquot. And what her and Louise Pomeray is the other person, what the two of them, in addition to the Widow Clicquot's technical innovations as a winemaker, they were the two who were really responsible for beginning what we think of as wine tourism. Because late in the Widow Clicquot's life, she had a chateau where she welcomed people in to come and buy wine. So, you know, that kind of wine country tour. And then Louise Pomeray, noticing a generation later that the Widow Clicquot is having really great success with this, she then opens her chateau, which she builds right in the middle of town, right by the railway station, so that people can come from Britain in order to visit her caves as well. So those two women really pioneer what we think of as wine tourism.
And wine tourism is something else that you've written about. You have also books about the back roads of Sonoma and of Napa.
Yeah, and recently one also of New York State. We had just
Great.
Yeah, just in the last year or so. And that was because right around the time I was finishing The Widow Clicquot, you know, I mean, I'm a total wine geek, right?
So I'm kind of getting that.
Like, you know, all the best people are wine geeks, right?
Yeah.
And so I had moved, at that point, we moved to Sonoma County. And really what it was is that when I first moved there, I was passionately interested in wine and winemaker, and I already knew that, you know, I wanted to think about winemaking. But I was just intimidated by those signs that you saw at the end of dirt roads, which I think is one of the most charming things about Napa and Sonoma, is that there's a lot of small family producers. But the idea of driving down the dusty road in order to introduce myself to the winemaker, it just seemed a little intimidating. So what I ultimately did in those guides is I wrote the book that I wished had existed when I moved there, which is, they're kind of atmospheric descriptions of the story and the wine behind these small family producers. So people producing, you know, always under 10,000 cases, usually under 2,000 or 3,000 cases, sometimes only producing 100 cases of wine a year. But it's not the wine that you're going to find in the grocery store distributed across the country, right? These are the really small family artisanal winemakers who, you know, who are the ones who are out there pruning in the fields and, you know, in the cellar when you arrive.
It's just kind of cool to know that they exist, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just such a different experience of wine tourism to go and meet the person who, you know, is making the wine and is growing the grapes and can give you this direct and very authentic experience of somebody who is making a wine they love.
I think that's so great. I want to do that. Now I got to get your book, and I got to go to Napa, and I got to go to Sonoma, because I've been there a billion times, but I want to do it with your book.
We need a girl weekend here, obviously.
Clearly. Well, what's exciting also for Naples is you're kind of coming home to roost a little bit, because you're going to be here later this week.
That's right. Yes. So at the end of the week, talking about Veuve Clicquot, drinking a little bit of wine.
Yeah, and that's going to be at the wine store in Naples. You're going to be doing a book signing as well.
That's right.
So, and you're from Port Charlotte. Let's not forget.
Let's not forget. No, I was born in Port Charlotte. So, yeah, always looking forward to coming back. Yeah, I don't get back as often as I'd like, but I do think of it as home.
I also wanted to talk a little bit about your wine. You make wine now. So during all of this exposure to the wine world and the business failures and the difficulties, you've decided to go ahead and try to make wine.
No, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Yes.
Where are you making wine?
So I ended up marrying a Canadian, and I emigrated, 5 years ago to British Columbia, to Vancouver Island, and we started about 4 years ago a winery on Vancouver Island. So if anybody makes it out to Victoria, we're just north of Victoria, you know, where Bouchard Gardens and the Empress Hotel is.
I've been there. It's beautiful.
Yeah, isn't it beautiful? I know. We have palm trees in front of the house in Canada. It's hard to believe.
I know.
But so we make, I, of course, make some sparkling wine, and I'm learning how to riddle myself. But we also do natural and raw wine, so we've become really passionately interested in that wine movement.
What grapes are you working with up there?
Mostly Gamay Noir, and Pinot Gris. I also have some smaller plantings of things like Maréchal Foch, which is a funny kind of hybrid, German hybrid varietal, and then Ortega, which is a kind of Riesling cousin.
Okay, so you're a 100% wine geek.
I'm a total wine dork.
All right.
It's just hopeless. There's no saving me any longer.
I'm right there with you. I'm the same. Although I live in Florida, so we will not be having any grapes down here.
No, you might not. That's probably true.
Well,
but
thanks.
You can still drink.
That happens. Thanks so much for talking with us, and we look forward to meeting you later this week when you come to Naples for the book signing.
Thanks. Can't wait to see you all then.
That was Tilar Matzeo, author, winemaker, and scholar, talking about her book, The Widow Clicquot. She'll be in town tomorrow night at the wine store in Naples on Central Avenue from 6 to 8 p.m. for a book signing and wine tasting. More information is at thewinestorenaples.com. When we return, the Southwest Florida-based rock band The Electric Mud performed live in our studios earlier this year. We'll listen back to that segment before the band returns home from their second multi-state tour later this month. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.